We are beginning the semester with Hilchos Taruvos, a section of a Yoredeya that covers from Simen Tzadi Ches to Simen Kuf Yud Aleph. The notion of a Taroves, of a mixture of two things, presumes that we are dealing with Isser and Heter combined. As a general rule, with probably two exceptions, if you're dealing with two elements of heter, there's not a problem of combining them. And if you're dealing with two items of iser, there's no necessity of combining them to have a problem. Before we start talking about, I want to introduce a few things before we actually start looking at the Mishnayos, and I'll explain to you why I've given you the Mishnayos to do. So I wanted to just review very briefly, what are Isurei Achila in the Torah? If you want to see a presentation of a very interesting way of looking at it, you can read the Rambam for the first like 9 prakam of Hilchos Macholos Asuras, or really going into the 10th parak. But generally speaking, the starting point of a discussion, and you can think about this when you talk about, someone asks you, does a certain kind of restaurant or does a certain kind of food require hashgacha? So of course the first question everybody's thinking is, what's the first question, the first checklist item that goes through your head?
Shabbos.
Really? I feel like we're getting warmer, but it's like, you know, we're still like the outer reaches of the solar system. What? I know, yes.
Just what are they serving at my Kazakashu
at? Well, I know, I understand that. What is here, David? No, just take care of that. Basar. The first thing is, you want to know, is it a fleshic restaurant or a milchic restaurant, right? There are modern Orthodox Jews, I don't know if there are also ultra-Orthodox Jews, but I know the modern Orthodox Jews, who will say, well, I eat out in dairy restaurants, or I eat out in vegan restaurants, okay? And there's maybe a big difference between those two, right? So the first question you ask, is it fleshics or is it not, right? So the first area, and this is the Rambam begins Hilchos Macholos Asuras with, is animal products. Everything, I guess, in the visible universe. I was very tempted to walk in with a cup of water here and ask you if there was a problem with my drinking it. It was filled in the bathroom sink. Some of you may remember. But in terms of the visible universe, right, you start out with the question of behema and chaya and oaf and dag. And within each of those four categories, there are tmeya and tahora, known in our nomenclature as kosher and non-kosher, or kosher and treif. Treif is a Yiddish word. Even the term kosher or kasher, while it's a Hebrew word, is not used in biblical Hebrew in the sense of kosher species. But rather, the terms would be behema tahora and behema tmeya. So you have behema tahora, behema tmeya. You have chaya tahora, chaya tmeya. Behema are the three, are shor chesed and eis. Chaya are ayel tzvi yachmora kovid ishon usov azomer. And pretty much split hooves, true, its cud will fall under one of those two categories. Among the ophos, the Torah lists 21 or 22, however exactly many, are treif. There are simanim halachalom mishimi sinai. All the other birds are kosher. Of course, we only eat birds with a mesora. Amongst dugim, we know that there are two simanim the Torah gives, snapir v'kaskesas. And then beyond that, pretty much everything, and then there's, I should mention, chagavim as well, grasshoppers. Outside of that, pretty much all the other creatures in the world, if they don't fall into these sort of five domains, are going to fall under sherets of one kind or another. Sherets aret, sherets amayim, sherets oaf. Some things fall into multiple categories. But the first kinds of machal asuras start with, is the meat, flesh, and whether the object, the animal in question, is kosher or non-kosher. That's the first starting point. Then, once we sort of select it down and we're dealing with a kosher species, so then a whole bunch of isurim that come into play within kosher animals. Nevela and treifa. Nevela, an animal that died without a proper shechita, without a shechita at all, or with a botched shechita. Or treifa, an animal that had a proper shechita, but nonetheless there was something wrong with the animal itself. It's typically an internal injury, occasionally something external. Nevela and treifa exist by behema, chaya, and oaf. They don't exist by dog. That is an interesting question. How do you know that a dog doesn't require shechita? There is a shechita, by the way, the Beis Yosef quotes early on in Yoredeya, that dogim don't require shechita, but you do have to catch them, as opposed to if they float up dead. You know why? What do you think, you are an Amora or something, making an expression? No. Yes?
Because either you could say it's a trefa, or it's analogous to finding a deer in
the woods. Hatzon uvakar yishachet lahem umatzah lahem, imes kod v'gei hayom, ye osef lahem umatzah lahem. So Beis Yosef quotes a sheet, I don't remember if it's Eldar Hadani or somebody else, who says that dogim require asifa. Right, so if the dog floats up dead, you might not want to eat it for other reasons, but if that, we assume a dog floats up dead, you're allowed to eat it. And Chagavim also don't require Shechita. That's not explicit either. Yehuda?
The Rosh says that Chagavim don't even require
it,
but then they're asked
it. Okay, fine.
Where does that leave it from?
From the Pasuk
of Balos. No, who makes that leave?
In the Beis Yosef course, I don't remember if it's an Eldar Hadani Hilchos Eretz Yisrael. What? Do you know who Eldar Hadani was? Eldar Hadani was a character. We have of Eldar Hadani, they published the Mekitzei Nerdamim, who put out a lot of these sort of old svarim, old manuscripts or things that had been published in a long time. The Mekitzei Nerdamim put out, it's just a small part of one volume. If next time you're at my house, I'll show you the volume. Hilchos Eretz Yisrael, the Eldar Hadani. So the idea that women can't do shechita, by the way, comes from Hilchos Eretz Yisrael. That's where the Beis Yosef quotes it from, rejects it. But the Ramah quotes the Agur, but it's adopted. It exists before. So Eldar Hadani apparently claimed to be one of the members of the Aseret Hashvatim. That's why he's Eldar Hadani. He was interesting. He was very interesting, and a lot of interesting shechitas in Hilchos Eretz Yisrael. Anyway, nevela and trefa, then within a kosher animal that's been properly slaughtered, you still have to deal with, certain parts that are problematic. Number one, dam. Dam is prohibited in behema, chai, and oaf. It's not prohibited, certainly in the Torah, in dagim, ofos, or adam. Chelev. Chelev is prohibited only in a behema. Chelev are certain specific fats and a few. I don't believe that the chemically speaking there's any difference between chelev and permissible fat, which is known as shuman. It has to do with certain locations in the anatomy, in the digestive tract, in the kidneys, and a couple of other places. Everything else is called shuman. So chelev of a behema only, not of a chaya or an oaf. And finally, gid hanasha, which applies by behema and chaya. It would at least not apply by oaf because an oaf doesn't have the appropriate anatomical parts to have a gid hanasha. So those are, I don't know if I've left any out, but those are sort of the first discussion of machalos asuras, both of non-kosher species and within kosher species, parts of the animal that are prohibited. Now, the Rambam then goes on to note, he lists four things that do not come from animals, but nonetheless are prohibited. And that list is orla, which are the fruits of a tree that grew in the first 3 years from the time it was planted. Kilaya kerem, which the way we paskin specifically, we have a special kul by kilaya kerem, that you only chayav on kilaya kerem when you plant kilayim in the kerem, which means it's already kilayim to start with, so two species of wheat, or something like that, chitosora and bachartzon, which is the grape seed, b'mapo lasyad. Okay, that's
meaning if it just happened to grow together by itself.
That could still be kilayim, but that's a separate discussion. Maybe I shouldn't give so much detail. Kilei zraim, non vineyard kilayim, you're allowed to eat. You're not allowed to plant. And in Eretz Yisrael, you're not allowed to leave if it grew on its own. But there's no prohibition in eating kilayi zraim. But kilayi kerem is aser b'achila and it's aser b'hana. So orla kilayi kerem tevel, which is any produce which has not had trumas and maisers properly separated from it. Included in that is a dough which has not had challah separated from it. And finally chadash. Chadash is the most interesting of all of these prohibitions for a very simple reason. No, not the reason you're laughing at, Sam. Why is chadash such an interesting prohibition? Because it becomes mutter. Okay? What's that? Absolutely, categorically not. The tree becomes mutter. There's the fruits that grow in the fourth year are mutter, are revai, and the fifth year mutter deep, but the orla fruits are usher forever. What's it? Tevel is always us. You can fix tevel. So yes, in that sense, it's different. But chadash becomes, the difference between tevel and chadash, and it may not be a difference really, is that tevel requires you to do something, whereas chadash does not. Chadash is memela. What? You don't have to bring the carbon omer. If you don't bring the carbon omer, it's mutter minimally on the next day. We don't bring a carbon omer today. Right, but you can grow grain in Eretz Yisrael and eat it. Itzumo shoyom, in one form or another, it renders it permitted. There are, of course, other machalos asuros But they're all sort of, I would say, conditional or provisional. In the area of Kudshim, you have Machalos Asuros. Some of them are only prohibited to some people. And we have any Kohanim here? Raise your hands high. I always like to know. I don't know. I almost never get Kohanim. Taven, okay, you're the only Kohen. I guess I know. Everybody's going to give you the Pidyon HaBen money. So a Kohen is allowed to eat Kutche Kutchim. He can eat from the Chatas, can eat from the Asham. He can eat the Chazav Ashok. Well, Chazav Ashok of the Shlamim is not Kutche Kutchim, but only a Kohen and family members can eat it. So there are part things in Kutchim that only Kohanim can eat. There are things in Kutchim that only Tahorim can eat, and there are things in Kutchim that nobody can eat, like Pigol and Nosar and Tameh. And then, even not within Kutchim, you have other things that have limited prohibitions within the world of Truma. Kohen can eat Truma and Trumas Meiser and Chala and Bikurim. Azar cannot eat that. Meiser Rishon, we paskin, anybody can eat Meiser Rishon. Rabbi Meir Shita was that only a Levi can eat Meiser Rishon. A Nazir is not allowed to eat Kalayotzim and Agefen, whereas everybody else can. Finally, Meiser Sheni and Nether Revai, the fruits of the fourth year, and the Meiser Sheni can only be eaten by Tahorim in Yerushalayim. Right, so there are other restrictions, but they tend to be mostly sort of conditional. Whereas everything sort of listed until here are sort of basic straight out Isurim for everybody. Okay, so basically, now I left out one very important Isur, which we will spend a large part of this year dealing with, which is only one of the only two things, as best I can tell, that are kind of like TNT. You know, I don't know what all the, maybe my chemist will tell me what TNT is comprised of, but it's comprised of, what's that? It is comprised of fairly innocuous ingredients. However, when they are placed together, they can be quite deadly. In that sense, there are two Isurim, one which we mentioned, which is Kilayim or Kilay Zraim, which are both permitted independently. In other words, the Kerem is permitted and whatever Zraim that you would plant are permitted, but you plant them together and they become Asur. And the other very important one for our discussion, obviously, is Basar B'Chalav. Basar B'Chalav is two positives equals a negative. And it is regarded for that reason, not clear if that reason only or maybe other reasons, as a tremendous chiddush. The idea that basar is permitted and chalav is permitted, but basar b'chalav is prohibited. Okay, now before we move on to the Mishnayos, I wanted to just do two more things, which is to provide you a little bit of an outline of Hilchos Taruvos, just to understand sort of in very broad strokes the issues that we're going to be dealing with. And then I wanted to introduce a few basic things of terminology, and I may be leaving a lot of things out, but they're things I think we're going to encounter. I know we will encounter repeatedly, and we will encounter soon. I just want you to be sort of familiar with those. So firstly, as far as the outline, those of you who know where Hilchos Basar B'Chalav is found in Shulchan Aruch may be wondering, why is it that I am starting with Hilchos Taruvos? Hilchos Taruvos runs from Simen Sadi Ches to Simen Kuf Yud Aleph. Hilchos Basar B'Chalav runs from Simen Pei Zayin to Simen Sadi Zayin. So, of course, I know arithmetic, and even if I didn't know arithmetic, I could open the Shulchan Aruch, and I know that Hebrew runs from right to left, and I know that Aleph comes before Tav, and you're wondering, why is it that we're doing Hilchos Taruvos before Basar B'Chalav? I'd like to say that the Kasha is backwards. The Kasha is on the Tur. Why did the Tur put Hilchos Basar B'Chalav before Hilchos Taruvos? Now, I can answer that question also. The Tur probably put it before because Basar B'Chalav is sort of related to Dvarim HaYotzeim and HaChai. And the first part, Yerideya, begins with Shechita, and then Kisrei Adam, and then Hilchos Trefos, and then it deals with sort of all the animals that are prohibited, you know, Hilchos Beitzim, Hilchos Dagim, Hilchos Ofos, Hilchos Chagavim, you name it. And then Basar B'Chalav is sort of a natural capstone to that, because Hilchos Taruvos is kind of generic. It's followed by Machalei Akum, like after Taruvos you have Pas Akum, Bishal Akum, Chalav Akum, Chalev Akum, and Gvinas Akum, and then you have Nemanos and Hagalas Kelim and Tfilas Kelim, and then Yayin Nesach and so on, kind of all these the Rabbanans. So the Tur was basically finishing up animal preparation. Right? That's really effectively how the Tur is ordered. It's how you prepare the animal for consumption. So that's nice, but unfortunately, in order to do Basar B'Chalav, there are lots and lots of things that would be very useful to have from Hilchos Taruvos. So that's why we're beginning with Hilchos Taruvos. Unfortunately, there are a couple of things that come up in Hilchos Basar B'Chalav that are very important to know whenever you're learning Hilchos Taruvos, such as a concept which will become very much your friend, which is known as Hanan. Some of you might have a friend who's named Hanan, but you probably regard him positively. Hanan is a poseik's nightmare. Hanan stands for Chati Hanas Es Nevela. And it's a concept that originates in Basar B'Chalav. Some Rishonim claim it's limited to Basar B'Chalav. But other Rishonim, particularly Chachmei Ashkenaz or some of Chachmei Ashkenaz, claim that the concept exists well beyond that. And if it does exist well beyond that, well, guess what? It's very important when you're learning Hilchos Tarovos and lots of Ramahs and lots of Shachs and Tazes to know Hanan, except that Hanan is found in Siman Sadi Beis, I think. And there are a couple of other things also to be aware of that are taught at Hilchos Basar B'Chalav. So, in fact, we're basically in a no-win situation, because if you start with Basar B'Chalav, there are lots of things you really need to know from Tarovos. If you start from Tarovos, there are lots of things you need to know from Basar B'Chalav. But certainly from a pedagogical, conceptual perspective, it makes sense. I'm not the only one. Not all of us do this way, but I'm one of any number of people who've chosen, when teaching this, to teach Hilchos Tarovos first, and I will try to sort of fill in the parts that you need to know. From Basar B'Chalav, enough to handle it here, even though we may deal with those issues in their fullest form when we go back to Hilchos Basar B'Chalav. One other area which I will not do, even though, again, we will have to refer back to it, and this is earlier, and it does have a few things, not so much that's relevant to at least one siman in Hilchos Taruvos, which has to do with how flavors transfer, is found in Hilchos Melicha. And Melicha is found after Hilchos Dam, which is right after Hilchos Trefos, in the late Samachs and early Ayins. So again, there are some things that we will have to fill in from earlier stuff as we do certain parts of Taruvos, but most of Taruvos sort of stands on its own. I think that you will probably also find, for those who are more interested in the conceptual, that Taruvos provides sort of the most interesting parts. The latter part, well, I'll give you the outline of Taruvos, but probably some of the, you know, most widespread lamdus and really significant lamdus comes at the end of Hilchos Taruvos, in Dinim of Sfeikos and Rove, and all sorts of really interesting things, some of which we will do, not in their entirety, but we will do some of them. The Hilchos Taruvos begins by talking about the basic rules of Bittul. Bittul, when you have mixture, is typically what we call lach belach. What lach belach means is things that blend together. Literally, lach means moist, but it doesn't actually mean in this context moist only. In other words, if you take liquids and you put them together, that's called lach belach. If you take flour and you blend it together, that's also called lach belach. What lach belach means is davar hanivla, something that actually blends, as opposed to chickens. If I have seven chickens which are shlutos in front of me and they get mixed together, you know, they're not blended together. Each one of the seven chickens stands discreetly by itself. And so that's called taroves yavesh b'yavesh. As a general rule, yavesh b'yavesh is essentially always dry. Lach b'lach can be either. Adin? Complicated. Okay, from there the tour moves on to talk about how you calculate the shiurim of bittul when you're actually evaluating mixtures, what counts towards iser, what counts towards heter, and then he closes that siman with a very important discussion of bittul iser lachatchila. You know, a woman picks up the phone and says, "Rabbi, some milk fell into my pot, you know, into the meat. So what do I do?" So of course the clever rabbi says, "Well, why don't you just add more meat to the pot, then you won't be able to taste the milk." Well, that's called bittul iser lachatchila, and whether that works or doesn't work, or where it works or doesn't work, is a very important discussion. From there, those are the first two simanim of Hilchos Taruvos. Simanim kuf through kuf beis start to deal with the question of bittul of things that are too important to be batel. The concept of bittul, conceptually speaking, could really be approached in one of two ways. One way of looking at bittul is that something basically disappears. It's, for all intents and purposes, not detectable, not discernible. That seems to be more of a physical description. The other way of looking at bittul, and these may sometimes overlap, is a question of what we'll call safek, right? If I have three pieces of meat, halacha l'maisa, I have three slices of salami on the table, and two of them are kosher, and one of them is treif. The halacha is, it's a machlokes, exactly, but let's say one daya is the rush that I can take the three pieces of salami, put them on club sandwich, add a little mustard, and eat it. The Rashba is a little more machmir, that I shouldn't put them on one sandwich, so I can put them on two different sandwiches, and then I could eat them. Mikar din, that's really how we pass. And I think the Ramah, I don't remember if the Ramah quotes a chumrah to take that maybe one person shouldn't eat all three. So instead, Tevin and I, even though the Torah says, Nevela trefa lo yachlu hakohanim, nonetheless, I will give him one sandwich, and I will have the other sandwich. So that's a case where you can't talk about really bittul in the sense of it's ki'ilu eino, in other words, as if it's disappeared in the sense of it's indiscernible. It certainly is discernible. When one of us eats a sandwich, at some point, one of us is discerning it quite clearly. However, it really seems to be working from a concept bittul that works mitzad safek. In other words, when according to the Rashba, that one person can eat all three, let's say, according to the Rashba, so I eat the first one. What is the probability that this is the tres salami? The answer is 1 in 3. A rova says mutter, excellent. Now I go to the second salami, what's the probability? The answer is 1 in 3, that it's aser. Therefore, a rova says it's mutter, excellent, I eat it. And the same thing when it comes to the third one. And obviously, I don't care about the cumulative effect, but the bottom line is it seems to be a bittul that works mitzad, safek, and rove, as opposed to, I don't know that it's here anymore. And when a tiny drop of milk, what's saying David, tiny drop of milk falls into my pot of meat, the reason why it's batel conceptually is because I can't taste the milk anymore. It's like it has vanished from the face of the earth. David?
Yeah, so at least regarding the term discernible, what do you mean by that one piece of meat still being discernible? If the only difference in discerning is regarding taste, are you able to discern
the taste? I can't tell when I'm eating it, but I certainly, in other words, I ask you, did you taste the treif salami? The answer was I did. I just didn't know when I was tasting it. Whereas when it comes to the milk and the meat, I literally cannot taste the milk.
Well, I'm asking, is it even the same concept of bittul? Because by milk and meat, there's a different taste to begin the discussion, and then you've lost that due to an overwhelming
effect. So my point is exactly that there's a difference between bittul of min bimino and min b'she'ino mino. Right? It's exactly the point. In other words, it doesn't have to only be in discrete items. You can theoretically, and you will see this sometimes in the Mishonim, and it's clear the Tanaim are thinking about this in many ways, that when it comes to min bimino, even if it blends together in some sense, I'm still tasting the Isser. I just don't know when I'm tasting it. Right? Absolutely, absolutely correct. Okay, so the Shulchan Aruch deals here with three things that are not batel because they're because of something about them. One of them is beria, and that's the situation of an entire creature, an entire animal. Second is what's known as chaticha haru'uya l'skabed, ba b'fnei ha'orchim. For short, it's known as chaticha haru'uya l'skabed. It means it's a nice piece of steak that I would serve in a restaurant, I serve to a chashuv guest. So that also doesn't have bittul because of chashivus. Again, the idea is if bittul means we look at something as if it doesn't really exist anymore because we can't identify, some things are so important that they never batel. And then the concept of davar sheyesh lamatirin is that if you have something like chadash, for example, that falls into, gets mixed into yashan, it's not batel because it's a davar sheyesh lamatirin. We will talk about why that is. Again, that has to do with fundamental concepts of how bittul comes about. Sam? Davar hamamid is like a davar ha'asoy l'tam. In other words, normally we say that if you can't taste something, it's like it's not there. But what if you can't taste it, but it has left a definite impression? In other words, I can't taste the yeast, right? But the yeast transformed the dough in such a way that it looks different than it would have looked without the yeast. So that, we assume, is not batel midrabanan. But in other words, the idea is that in order to employ the principle of bittul, you have to say that the iser object no longer exists in the world. And if I can see it, then it's there. So here I can't see the yeast, but I can see the yeast has left a definite impression. Same thing is true, by the way. That's not davar hamayinit, that's davar hamachmit, so it's the same thing. When you think about rennet, rennet is the classic davar hamayinit, right? But it's for that reason, because the milk, I can't taste the rennet in the milk, not even a chance, right? If the rennet is far smaller proportion than you would ever be able to taste. And nonetheless, I can see the rennet has left a lasting impression. If you could theoretically take a vacuum and extract the rennet, I'm not sure that it's chemically possible, but if you could, it's still, the trees would be, the milk would be forever transformed because of that rennet. Okay, then the Shulchan Aruch has, before it turns its attention to what I'll call flavor transfer, there's one more siman where it discusses the concept of no saying tam lefgam, which is a very, very important concept. The woman calls up the rabbi and says, "Oi, rabbi, I cooked my the milk. I cooked my cheese. I melted it in a fleshik frying pan. What do I do?" In the end, well, the frying pan probably is going to get thrown out. But the cheese, in most cases, is going to be edible because probably, not always, the woman hasn't cooked in this pot with enough time that any flavor that's inside that pot is assumed to be pogam, the cheese. This is an exceedingly common application. That's kind of bread and butter of Rabbi Shaila's is, when was the last time you used the pot? Because no same time lefgam, we paskin, is mutter. So there's one simon that deals with that. Yes, Ruvain? I'm not sure they really, I mean, you can have a situation where both, I would say that you can only talk about the suffix model when the thing is still the end, is still extant, right? Once you get to be not being extant, then there's no point invoking the suffix model. Then the Shulchan Aruch spends a few simanim dealing with flavor transfer. One very long and difficult simon, simon kofei, deals with what we know as the three forms of heat in halacha, which is bishul, kavush, and maliach. That which is actually cooked together, that which is, I'll say maliach is considered hot still, maliach is salted, and kavush is pickled. And somewhere in that category also goes tzli and afiyah, meaning roasting and baking. I want to talk about those terms after I finish the quick survey. So simen kofei and simen kovav, I think, deals with recha. Some of you already encountered the Mishnayos. What is the status of not what appears to what we would call taste, but actually smell, and a couple of other things. And then the Shulchan Aruch, when it gets to simen kuftes, moves to the stuff that is perhaps the most fascinating. Simen kuftes, I described before as bitul yavesh biyavesh, when I'm dealing with typically items that are the same, although what we call min bimino, where I have a taroves of yavesh biyavesh, they're each discrete items. You can, by the way, have a taroves of min b'she'eno mino yavesh biyavesh, and you guys have already encountered one, but you may not realize it. Normally we tell someone, can you have a taroves of yavesh biyavesh, min b'she'eno mino, two different species, you look at me like I'm crazy. What are you, blind, right? I have two hammers and a wrench. Okay, you know, if you're like, yeah, one of the Monty, whatever the games they play on the street, I'll cover one up and now I'll take them off. Where's the wrench? Right? They're different. How do you have a taroves? Taroves means that it's mixed together that you can't identify it, right? If you can identify it, it's not a taroves. So there is a way of getting it, and I want to know now. We'll see when we get, you encountered this, if you got through certain of the Mishnayos, you actually were dealing with what is a taroves yavesh biyavesh min b'she'eino mino. But you probably had never thought about that question, so you weren't thinking about it, the Mishnayos in light of that. That's also, by the way, why when you learn something for the first time, the second time, it's nothing like you would learn it for the first time. Okay, and then Simon Kofyud deals with one of the most mathematically, logically intriguing concepts in halacha. It deals with all sorts of sfeikos, in particular the question of kavua and parish. I don't wish to discuss it other than to describe to you what this idea is. I'm not going to explain why, even if I could explain why, that's a question mark. The halacha is that if there are 10 butcher shops that are selling meat, 9 of them are selling kosher meat, and one of them is selling treif meat. If you walk into one of those butcher shops and you don't look at the tuda, so you don't know whether it says galat kosher or galat treif, and you buy a piece of meat and you come home, and then your wife says, where did you buy it from? And I said, I don't remember. In that case, the halacha is that it's considered as a safek mechtzal mechtza. It's a 50-50 safek, and therefore it is presumably it's going to be treated as treif. If, however, a little birdie flew into one of the shops, picked up a piece of meat, and then after the shopkeeper was screaming at it, but dropped the piece of meat right in the middle of the teisha of the 10 chanuyos, and you come along and you pick up that piece of meat, the halacha is called the parish meruba parish. If the majority of the butcher shops were selling kosher meat, that meat is kosher. One of them seems to be probability, and one of them seems to be possibilities. Why that is the case is very interesting in its own right. I think when we deal with this, we will go about the classic route of what I'll call briskerdom, which is describing what, not describing why. Okay, and then the last simon is all based upon a Rashba. About one of you asked me in Seder about what is this idea of Sha'ani Omer. She'ani Omer is what I would term in English what's called wishful thinking. And sometimes the halacha allows us to engage even in the concept of the real world of tarovis and wishful thinking. So if I have a saw of truma and a saw of chulin, and I have a box of chulin, and I have a box of truma, and one falls into one, and one falls into the other, so in certain circumstances, we permit the chulin, we treat it as chulin, shani omer, chulin l'to chulin nafal, and truma l'to truma nafla, we'll talk about that as well. So that basically, in a very brief nutshell, is Hilchos Taruvos. Just a few, before we turn to the Mishnayos, a few issues of terminology. I already spoke about lach balach and yavish biyavish. Lach balach means two things that actually blend together. Yavish biyavish means things that remain discrete. We talk about mimbimino and mimbishaino mino. Classically speaking, although this is a lot more complicated, we usually think about mimbimino and mimbishaino mino is dependent upon taima. Depends upon taste. There is a very funny Ramah that the Shach beats up on. In the first siman, in Hilchos Taruvos, the Ramah says that we follow, for min mimino purposes, we don't pay attention to taste, we follow shema. What is it called? What is the name of the object? And if the name is the same, if it's like red pepper and white pepper, even if they taste different, totally different, that is called min mimino. And they could taste the same, but if they have different shemas, that's called mimishaino mino. We will discuss that Ramah. It's a very problematic Ramah. It should suffice to say for the moment that in many areas of Taruvas, when we say mimimino, mimishemino, we mean taste. But there may be situations where the Ramah's principle, the Shach agrees, is relevant. Yehuda? Of course we would. Absolutely. The Shach would absolutely have. There's a whole discussion, by the way, Chelev and Basar are two ta'amim, but Chelev and Shuman for sure is mimbimino. According to that Ramah, it would seem to not be, yes. Yes. Okay. And the last thing I want to just talk about is, I mentioned already Kabush and Maliach. Maliach obviously is salted. How salty does it have to be? That's a whole discussion in the Rishonim. That actually is in Hilchos Basar B'Challah. I think it's in Basar B'Chalav. I don't think it's in Malicha. It's in Basar B'Chalav. Kavush is a whole machlokas harishonim. We usually tend to think of pickling means you put it in something with a lot of salt or vinegar or something of that nature. And there are some rishonim who say that, in fact, in order to be kavush, it has to be so. However, there are others who say, and the way we usually work with an assumption, is that sitting in any liquid for a certain amount of time, to be determined later, or discussed later, is called kavush. It could be sitting in water, and that's called kavush, if it's sitting for a long enough time. Some of you may know this from the, Rabbi Penner said that you're supposed to help clear the table. That's true. It's a mitzvah. For those of you who are married, you know that by now. I hope you know that by now. And those of you who are in your parents' home, you should help clear the table. It's very important. Okay, the next step is you should also help prepare for Pesach. And one of the things you might do in helping prepare for Pesach is to wash the lettuce, right? And the concern with lettuce, of course, is beria. Everything comes back to you or there. You might have little bugs in the lettuce. Even though you might want to enhance your protein content, nonetheless, you're not allowed to consume the lettuce or the bugs. How do you clean lettuce? Well, one of the ways of doing it is you put the lettuce in water mixed with vinegar, right? And apparently that helps sort of dislodge the bugs, however it is, and they float to the surface, and then you have your bugs separate, you get rid of it, and you have your lettuce. So the question is, how long can you leave it soaking in that particular mixture? Because, or even if you left it in water, because the din is you're not yotze with maror if it's kavush. And therefore, you have to make sure that you're not kovesh the lettuce. So you have to know what is called kavush. So it comes up not only in Isser V'Heter, it comes up even in the context of Pesach. Fine. So that's kavush. Then the other major distinction within flavor transfer is the question of bishul versus tzli or afia. And the difference there is that bishul, by its very definition, means in a liquid. Tzli and afia means that the items are being cooked not in a liquid. They're being roasted over an open flame or dry, touching one another, but without a liquid medium in between them. The assumption, generally speaking, is that liquid mediums are much more effective for transferring flavor. I think that's generally true. I think it's fairly common sense and intuitive. Okay.
Frying, in this case, is the same as visual, or is it not oil?
So frying, as long as there is liquid in there, is considered a bishul. One of the things that I mentioned before, a Teflon frying pan is essentially unkasherable. The reason why it's not kasherable is because we require libun by frying pans, and you can't do libun on a Teflon pan. It will destroy the pan. The reason we require libun on a frying pan, if you fry in liquids, is because I think of a tshuva, the Ramami Panu, that's quoted by the Shach, I think, that maybe I'm being confused of who says what there, but that we're afraid you have to do libun. Let me just, skipping ahead to the end of the year, things that only require libun if it's something that you cook without a liquid medium. If you only do bishul with a kli or a pot, by definition, as a matter of principle, it never requires libun. It's only if you did sli or afia, where you did it dry, that the assumption is it's hard, in other words, it's burned on, it's burned in, and you need libun to get it out. So things you fry shouldn't require libun, except we're afraid that sometimes the shemen is kala, and then it's considered dry. So here it's sort of the reverse way. In other words, as long as there's oil or some liquid that it's being fried in, that's called bishul. If that evaporates, then it's only sli or afia. So the rules of tam transfer for these different things are all, they each has its own details, and we will eventually, God willing, explore that. All right, any questions so far? Okay, so now I'd like to turn our attention to the Mishnayos. I apologize, some of you figured this out, but I put these in brackets in small font on top. All of the Mishnayos, I think I gave you everything but the Tosafot and Trumos in the handout, but the piece on the bottom is a subset of that I really want you to do first. Now, why am I giving you Mishnayos to do? So, there are actually two reasons. One is because the Mishnayos, when you go dig throughout Shas, actually will give us a preview of so many of the major topics that we're going to address in Hilchos Taruvos. So that's reason number one. In fact, there's some Mishnayos that are really important because they're linchpins of arguments of the Rishonim over various issues, even where the Gemara didn't actually make a point about something. The second reason I want to give it to you is for the part that's not so much Halach Lamaisa, but from the vantage point of Lamdas, not Brisker Lamdas, but from understanding of the history of the development of Bittul and Hilchos Taruvos. And if I were to ask you, if someone calls you a Shailah Taruvos, okay, what's the question you really want to know from them? Two things got mixed together, and you want to know what? Okay, I know I told you that before, but two foods got mixed together, okay? And what's the question you're asking, of course? What's that?
The amounts.
Yes, and you want to know, what are you really asking when you're asking the amounts? What are you looking for? In one number. Sum up in one number. Shishim. Okay? Where in the Mishnayos does Shishim appear? Nowhere. There's a big machlokas harishonim about this particular question. Arguably, the Mishnayos point in the direction of the way we actually paskin, like Rabbeinu Tam and like the Rambam, is that Shishim is fundamentally irrelevant. Shishim is just a rule of thumb when you don't know better. But fundamentally speaking, what question are you really asking, Adin? Is it no same Tam? That's the question you're asking. Because our entree to the world of Taruvos is backwards. It's backwards in the sense of it comes from the mimetic tradition, what happens in your parents' home, what happens when something goes wrong and someone picks up the phone and calls the rabbi, and the rabbi is asking the end of the line question, we tend to think the shir is shishim. Now, shishim is just again, there may be other opinions in the Mishnah, but the way we paskin, and you read the Mishnayos where shishim does not even appear, shishim is simply a handy guide, which is not applicable under all circumstances. Yudi? You're a Sephardi, you don't have a problem, get a guy. Ashkenazim have a problem. It's machlokas the mechaber the Ramah. What's that? I know what meat tastes like. I know what ground beef, a hamburger, tastes like. So you put in, some trefe sriracha, and I want to know whether you can taste it or not, okay? Do you taste sriracha in there or not? That's not hard. Matt? Some, So you might have already seen it in the Mishnayos. The Mishnayos, I'm going to give you the Gemara's formulation, the Milsa David al Taimas lo betela, because the answer really is not Shishim. The answer is it no same top? Right? It requires, you know, I think it took me to the second, first, maybe the second time teaching Yerideh to fully internalize, you know, I had learned it once, and then teaching it sent to fully internalize that shift, that really it's all backwards, that only the Amorayim, and not first generation Amorayim, who are finally settling on the question of Shishim. If you think about that, there's a Gemara I'm going to learn fairly early on in the next couple of weeks on Daf. I think it's Tzadi Zayim, Tzadi Chesam and Aleph. This sequence of Bittul where they went to Rebbe and his father and his grandfather and they'd given different numbers and it's less than Shishim. And you have to remember when you're reading that Bryce, at least Kipshuto, they don't know Shishim as a number. Right? Shishim does not exist as a number until second or third generation Amorayim, and then it doesn't even seem to establish firm status as accepted until the end of the Gemara. Right? So even if you find fourth generation Amorayim still working with other terms, well, that's because it's not a settled matter. For us, it's a settled matter. But when you read the Mishnayos, you sort of get a perspective of where things are starting from. Yehuda? So normally when you get the shayla, if the person, you know, threw carrots into the meat, if a little meat fell in, the Gemara talks about shishim as a number that works for most things. If they put, you know, orla spices in the thing, and they tell you it was treif spices I put in, so then all of a sudden you have to say, well, then you know that spices are almost by definition a mislevi l'taima. Again, the way it's presented in the Gemara is that the Chacham will Mishayer for most things, and they took the more flavorful things, and 60 is enough to be mevatel almost anything, except for things that are Milsa D'Dila Taima. So the answer is yes. You know, if you can all of a sudden taste something, then it doesn't matter. Listen, I had a Shaila several years ago where someone, one of the things you will, they're among the bedeviling substances you have to deal with at Hilchos Taruvos are the members of the onion family. Okay? And the menu, in halachic terms, we talk about a davar chara, but it's not just that. You know, or you should know, and if you live at home, you probably never do this because, you know, probably your mother or somebody else in the family handles this. But if you're living in an apartment here and you share a refrigerator with other people, word to the wise, don't leave uncovered onions or garlic, you know, that's been cut in the fridge. Bad idea. There's for whatever reason, they have tremendous powers of both attraction and smelling everything up. So I forget what it was. I don't know if it was onions or not. It might not. It might have been, there was like chocolate and turkey had been left uncovered in the fridge. Okay, not touching one another. And a student came to me and said, but you can sort of taste the turkey and the chocolate, and I forget which way it was. So they never touched one another. So I asked Rashech, and he said, yeah, if he can taste it, then it's aser, which raises very profound problems about Recha Milsa and Recha La Milsa. We'll talk about them when we get there, because as you realize, as the chemist can tell you, Recha, out of a chemical perspective, of course is a Milsa. If you're smelling it, it means there are particles of one that got into the other, which I don't think the Chazal or the Rishonim realized. And that may not impact upon the Halacha. Right, Recha just, obviously, Recha doesn't entail that much that got in it, and we might just say that that's called Batel. You know, we might say if it's not Mamashus in the classic sense, but anyway, it's complicated. So the question of, I was responding to, who asked the question I'm responding to? What was your question? I wanted to come back. And you asked people whether they... Right, so sometimes, look, so I assume that people, if someone tastes something, the rabbi says it's mutter, and they go, you taste funny, you're smart balabasta is going to call, rabbi, I started eating it, but it tastes like the other thing, in which case the answer is, yeah, there's a problem, except that normally is not going to be the case. It happens to be, by the way, by the nature of food production and preparation today, our lives are actually much simpler because unless somebody accidentally bought a treif product, and it's rare that you actually buy a treif product. I once didn't. I'll tell you, it's better to be mivayish oneself because otherwise you'll be at my house and my wife will tell the story of the time that I bought a ShopRite turkey because I was told to get a turkey and I went to the kosher tub, and I pulled the turkey out of there, but someone unfortunately had put a shop, taken a ShopRite turkey out and put it in the non-kosher one. She comes home and sees, says, Jeremy, what's this non-kosher, what's this treif turkey doing in our freezer? I said, what are you talking about? She says, there's a ShopRite turkey here. Right? So that is a rare occurrence. It takes someone who's a little bit clueless to do that and not read the labels. So it's rare that you bring in Mevela, or Trefa, or Behema Tamea, or Of Tamei, or something with Dam, because your grandmother probably knew much more than you do about your dish. She actually knew how to prepare a chicken. You know, you can talk about a chicken, but she could actually do something with it. So it's been pre-salted, right? You don't have to worry about Chaylev, it's been trebered. You don't have to worry about Gid Anasha, it's been trebered. They don't have to worry about it. They don't even sell the hindquarters. They toss it in the treif pile not to deal with it. So basically, the only thing you can do in your kitchen, for the most part, is somehow mix milk and meat together. And we are pretty, it takes a lot, you know, it's not easy to do. You have to really be incompetent to mix milk and meat together. You know, unless you didn't realize that this particular food had milk in it. You know, milk was an ingredient, right? Right? Right. So in other words, it's pretty rare that you get, you know, so the range of possible mess-ups that you can have in the kitchen are pretty rare. So it's not like you're going to deal with too many of those questions. And just a word of caution, I will entertain you for a moment with a famous story, which is true. I'll tell you how I know it's true. We thought it might have been apocryphal, but just understand, maybe this should have been the first thing I said. You are learning Yerideah. Learning how to run a kosher kitchen by learning Yerideah is like learning how to drive by reading a manual about accidents. Okay? In other words, what you will be, if you learn properly this year, you will be qualified to handle what happens when things go wrong. But if you want to go and say to your mother or to your wife, oh, but we can do this, it's okay, and she says to you, no, we don't do this, you listen. Okay, I try not to listen, but my wife keeps reminding me. It's a famous story that's told about the Rav when the Rebbetzin was ill. So apparently the Rav and Chaim were handling the kitchen. And the Rebbetzin came down out of her sick bed and saw they had used the wrong towels for something like that. There's no such thing as milk, exfoliation towels, but whatever. Okay, whatever it was. And she started screaming at them, you're trafing at my kitchen. So the Rav said, but it's mutter. He said, it's perfectly fine. Chaim, go bring a Yerideah. So the Rebbetzin said, you and your Yerideah are trafing at my kitchen. Now, lest you think this is an apocryphal story, or you'd heard this story, and then many more years ago than I care to admit, I was waiting outside the Revel, not where it is now, where the old Revel lecture room was, and waiting for my wife finishing class with Dr. Soloveitchik, Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, and he started at the end of class to tell this story. So in fact, the story is a true story. So I just offer you those words of caution. Do not try to say, oh, Mom, you know what? You don't need two separate things here. Now, you might not, and if she's not using it, that's great. But if she is, don't mix them together. Don't make trouble, okay? It's not good for anybody, okay? So you don't, you know, there are traditions on how kosher kitchens are run. Your job is to know when something is treif after the fact. But if you want to know how you run a kosher kitchen, sh'al avicha v'yageicha zekeinecha v'yomru lach. Yes?
You said in terms that it's very hard to treif up the kitchen.
It requires really incompetence, yes.
The case where it occasionally happens where meat is sold as kosher and somewhere along the line someone is switching the treif to the kosher.
Okay. Okay, but you understand that today, unless, you know, you had a scandal in Muncie a number of years ago, you know, where there was someone, Bikavana, substituting Purdue chickens for kosher kitchens, but for kosher chickens. But I'm assuming no one's doing that, right? It's unlikely you're going to find, and again, unless you go into a non-kosher supermarket and pull out the black treif, you know, turkey or meat or whatever it is, you're not likely to ever bring into your house anything that's truly treif. Right, so the only thing that's left to do are the things are either kilai Yisrael, which is not likely, firstly, you know, whatever. There aren't too many Jewish farmers around, and whatever. It doesn't apply in full force in Chutz La'aretz. Anyway, whatever. We don't have to worry about that one. Or basar b'chalav. So that's the one case, right, you have to deal with. But even there, so it's rare that you're going to take chalav and mamish mix it into basar. Right, it can happen. Right, when it was a meaning milk ingredient, and if someone used the milk ingredient and they, you know, something put into the meat, which had a milk ingredient, you can already guess the probability is it's going to be batel b'shishin, right? Because that ingredient, you know, if someone, you know, took a stick of butter and put it in, well, you're pretty clueless if you put butter in the meat. But if you put some, you know, ketchup in that happened to have a little bit of milk in it, it's probably, milk might even be batel in the ketchup, it's certainly going to be batel in the meat.
What?
Okay, so we'll talk about that when we get to Hilchos Basar B'Challah.
Is no tikkun of gam defined individually or generally? Other than cilantro.
Let's wait till we get there. Yeah, I'll answer that question in brief. I think that if you particularly don't like something, that doesn't make it no tikkun of gam. Yes, Judah.
So would I be correct in saying that science is generally not necessarily the way we define things in Yerodea?
No, I don't think I said that, and I want to. Nagar, David Nagar sent me an article. I won't say by whom. I don't know when the article by a fine Talmud Chacham, who's no longer Bein HaChayim, about this, who wrote claiming he was talking about Kalim, that you can't use scientific experiments to prove that Kalim aren't Balea. I believe that he's 100% wrong. I think it's clear from so many Makoros that it is determined by Tom. He seems to have, it's a very serious Talmud Chacham. But he seems to be just glossing over certain passages in the Shulchan Aruch. A certain senior colleague of mine once made a claim about the Blias being metaphysical Blias. It's categorically wrong. The Gemara says a Kefela can taste it. In fact, the Gemara says a Kefela can taste it. A regular, non-expert, not a cook, not a chef, a Kohen can taste it. The Shulchan Aruch, we don't do this l'chatchila, but the Mechaber and Rama both rule that if you know, the classic case, you chop an onion with a milchik knife, you taste the onion. If you don't taste milchiks, it's part. Right? So the idea that somehow this is not determined by, called objective reality, I think is just categorically wrong. We may not always live our lives that way, especially when it comes to Blias Kalim in particular, but as a matter of principle, I think it is absolutely not the case that this is in the abstract. This is very real. You know, there's a line that said, the Rav said about Reb Chaim, that Yerodea was pots and pans until Reb Chaim came along. I think Yerodea is supposed to be pots and pans, but I'm not a brisker. Explain things. Reuven.
On that note, when you talk about reality, is it really subjective reality? Can you talk about, it's based on taste in run experience, if particle or transfer, is the way to say, there was a threshold of...
I'm not mistaken, the Rashba in the Torah Sabayis, uses the expression, it's Tam HaNirgash L'Rov B'nei Adam, right? The argument this Tam HaChacham made, by the way, is that our taste buds are no longer like their taste buds. I mean, talk about, I suspect that, what's that? I suspect that, I actually would like some evidence for that. I have my strong doubts about that, that there's any evidence to it. I can't rule out a possibility, number one. Number two, it may not matter. Even in Naniach, that our sense of taste has changed, it's Tama Nirgash L'Rov B'nei Adam. If it's no longer tasteable to people, then it's no longer tasteable, right? And again, the Shulchan Aruch was only 500 years ago. And the Shulchan Mechaber says, let's talk about Tam, right? It's not Chazal, you know, they might have had rabbinic supervision, but they didn't have rabbinic super taste. So, Chaim? I am very dubious about claims of this nature without evidence, right? I suspect strongly also, by the way, that there's a great degree of variety, I know, between different people, and that these are the kinds of things that actually can be learned very easily. There is a fair amount of evidence, or there's a good degree of evidence that our senses of smell are actually very powerful, but we don't use them, but people can be trained to use them. There are blind people who have trained to echolocate, who can actually ride bikes on trails and use echolocation. So I doubt that we have lost those capacities. I don't know. I don't think there's any Yeridas Hadoros. If you want to claim that our tastes are somehow, we are inferior in tasting, I can't rule it out. I understand that you can be more sensitive and less sensitive, and you can sensitize yourself and desensitize yourself. I'd like to see evidence for that claim that somehow we can't taste anymore. But certainly the Shulchan Aruch certainly still assumes, and I think we do lahalacha, that b'di'evit certainly, if you tasted the onion and you didn't taste milk and you tossed it in the cholent, it's mutter. Okay, the Rama and the Mechaber say you can taste l'chatchila, to make a determination. So And that's why I just don't think the claim that the kalim, you know, just because our kalim aren't bolea, you know, we don't, you know, we can't, because we can't taste. I don't think there's any basis for that. Yudi?
If shishim is just like an arbitrary number for the same time, why wouldn't the Amoraim or whoever came up with it, why wouldn't they just use like mea from the Mishnah?
Because it becomes a much bigger chumra. It is a machlokas. It's actually a machlokas. We're going to see on the bottom of Tzadi Chesamid Aleph, it's going to be a machlokas, but it's shishim or mea. We'll get there. Okay, but you're right. They could have picked the different. There's a lot more to be said. Let's wait. As we go through the Mishnayos, we'll talk about where some of these shiurim came from. Okay. So anyway, so let's start now with the Mishnayos. May I have a volunteer reader? I didn't thank you very much for your spiritual volunteerism. Mishnah Shviyas Perek Zayin Mishnah Zayin. Adin. As opposed to what? Yadin is not here anymore. Much to my chagrin, he abandoned me and he abandoned Daniel. But nonetheless, so now we hear a din at the end. You know, unless it's din v'cheshbon, it's your job. Okay, so I'm going to read here again. There may be multiple shitos here, but the Rambam understands this is the question, what gives tam and what? So he says that a newly vered, I assume, are roses, and the previous Mishnah, which I didn't give you, says that vered yeshlem shvias v'yeshlem biur. Just briefly, shvias means it has kedusha shvias, so it has to be treated with kedusha shvias. You have to eat it the normal way, and so on. And you can't engage in commerce with it. Biur means after the time that it is no longer available in the wild for the animals, you have to do biur on that which you gathered in. It's a machlokas, the Rambam and the Ramban, whether it means destroying it from the world or just means putting it out and declaring hefker so anybody can come and take it. So the Mishnah says that one of these things, in one way there's a tam transfer, meaning one way the shemen absorbs from the vered, the other way it doesn't absorb from the vered. So does the shemen require biur or not? It depends whether or not it absorbs the tam of the vered. Moshe?
Is oil a pickling substance?
It is, maybe.
No, because if it's not, then this could be a proof that kavash does not necessarily mean pickle, and it could mean like.
So the there is no question. I mean, the answer. I think you're right. I think you're correct that this would suggest that shemen. Except the problem is that. Yeah, fine. I agree. I think that's a good proof. Yeah, you know, it's going to be a kashya against certain comments of the Bishonim. I don't know if anybody raises the question or not. Go ahead. Harubim.
Rubin Chadashim Shekivsham B'yayin, Yayin Yashan, Yishanim Chadash.
Not Yishanim.
Yishanim.
Yes.
Yishanim Chadash, Chayim B'yur.
It's too early in the semester for that. but firstly, I just want to ask, who was eating Harubim? You know what Harub is? Otherwise known as boxer. It's dentist food. You know why it's dentist food? Because after eating, you need a visit to the dentist. You remember that? Did you guys get them in Lag BaOmer? They would give you boxer?
Two shots.
What's that?
That's what he was
eating. Oh, it's Lag BaOmer too. Oh, that's right. Maybe, okay. So yeah, the boxer, it's like inedible. Anyway, so they used to eat it. And I think it was generally fed to animals, actually. I think that's why even the Rambam agrees that the Rambam who says that Meiser Peirus Elon is Midaraisa, I think Meiser Charuvim is only the Rabbanon. The Gemara says that Peferish, and the Rambam says that Charuvim are the exception. Most Rishonim say all Peirus except for Dagan Tirus for Yitzar as only Trumas and Meiser Midarabbanon. Anyway, so Charuvim, either way, they emit flavor into the Yayin. Zehaklal, this is the part I really want. And Zehaklal, okay, but, and now the Mishnah almost seems to repeat Shvias. Okay, so the Mishnah here has introduced the first major issue in the question of Bittul, which is the difference between Mimbimino and Mimbishenomino. And it would appear from the Mishnah that the rule is that by Mimbishenomino, how do you have Bittul? You can't taste it. By Minbimino, how do you have Bittul? You don't. You don't. Okay, so your argument might be, you'll say maybe Shemitah is different. The Rambam here writes, if I'm not mistaken, in Perash HaMishnayos, that this is really for all other Isurim as well. Now, this is going to be one of the most vexing issues, and I still don't have an answer to it. I'm not sure if Tosfos and Menachos deals with this question. We are going to see that there's a famed machlokes of Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim, whether or not Min Bimino is Batel or not. Now, I would posit, al derech ha-mechkar, that there exists no such machlokes. It's almost inconceivable, but I don't know what to do with it. Now, truth is, when you look at this Mishnah, it seems to be very clear that there's bittul by min b'sheino mino, and there's no bittul by min b'mino. However, you learn the Mishnayos and Trumos. And what do you know from the Mishnayos and Trumos? There are two sections of Mishnayos and Trumos that I gave you. The first were in Perek Dalet and Hey, Perek Hey, and the latter ones were in Perek Yud. Now you probably weren't thinking about this question, but what was the difference between those two groups of Mishnayos? Dalet and Hey were all about Min Bimino. They didn't label it as such, right? But Truma L'toch Truma, it's like flour falls into flour. Mishnah Perek Yud was all about min b'she'eino mino, often in cooking or pickling or something, two different substances, and it was mino same time. Now, but the reason I highlight this difference is because in Perek Dalet and Hay, there is bittul by min b'mino. What's the sheer bittul? Mea. So what do you mean there's no... Now this is a double question. It's a question against the Rambam's comment here in Shvius. What do you mean b'chol ha'tarat kula, min b'mino is not batel? By Truma, it's Batel B'Mea. By Orlan Kalea Karim, which I don't know if any of you got to, it's Batel B'Masayim. So what do you mean there's no Bittel by Min B'Mino? Of course there's Bittel by Min B'Mino. And further question, how can the Gemara claim Rabbi Yehuda says that there's no Bittel by Min B'Mino? I don't remember if he appears explicitly in these Mishnayos. I bet you if you look in the Tosefta, he appears. Are all of these Mishnayos against Rabbi Yehuda? Are all of them against Rabbi Yehuda? Hayitachin? Now, there's a reason why the Gemara says that Min B'Mino for Rabbi Yehuda is not Batel. Because there's a Mishnah in Zvachim. Some of you may know this. Maybe you learned this in the context of Yoma. Ein Dam Mevatel Dam. Right? How do you know that Ein Dam Mevatel Dam? Anybody know the source for that? Yom HaNoraim is coming up. I know that some of you gloss over when you get to the Avodah, but you shouldn't. You should learn Mishnayos Yoma, and then you'll know what's going on. V'lakach midam ha-par midam ha-so'ir v'nasan al-kanor sam is be'ef tzaviv. After the Kohen sprinkles the dam of the par and the dam of the sar, he sprinkled them inside. He sprinkled them out on the outside of the parochas. He blends the two bloods together, and then he puts them on the mizbeach hazav. Says v'lakach midam ha-par midam ha-sar. Golav yadua that the dam ha-par is meruba midam ha-sar. If min b'mino were to be batel, what would the shear be? Min ha-Torah, obviously. A rov. Maybe it's not obvious, actually. That could be the answer, but we just assume. That's the bottom line, halacha, that min ha-Torah, min b'mino is batel b'rov. So if the dam ha-par is meruba from the dam ha-sar, then how can the Torah, if the Kohen mix them together, how can it be v'lakach mi dama par mi dama sa'ir still? There's no dama sa'ir anymore. It's different. It's gone. It's batel. It's avram and olam. So Rabbi Yehuda says, ein dam mevatel dam. It has relevance elsewhere in Kachim. And the Mishnah Zachim talks about the context. I'm not for a moment arguing that Rabbi Yehuda is clear what he holds there. The question is that a din that's unique in Kachim or unique to certain circumstances? Because what about all of these Mishnayos in Trumos and in Orla that speak about bittul min b'mino? Rabbi Yehuda disagrees with all of them? The problem gets worse, by the way, because actually the question of bittul, min b'mino, if I'm not mistaken, is a big machlokes ha-moraim in Avodah Zarah, and it comes up a little bit in Zachim, Rav and Shmuel versus Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish. So it's an open question. You've got to keep this in mind as we go through, once we get to the tour in Beis Yosef itself, to the Sugyos. What do they do with these Mishnayos? These Mishnayos clearly speak, leaving out the Mishnah and Shmias, clearly speak about the bittul of min b'mino. Min b'mino is batel. Rabbi Yehuda disagrees with all of them? Maybe. Okay. Let's move on a little bit. Okay. Now let's go to, I asked you to do Ches and Tes in Perek Dalet. Go ahead.
Yeshua Omer, Te'inim Shorot Malot Halbanot, Halbanot Malot Halbanot. גדולי טבילה, הגדולים מעלים את הקטנים, והקטנים מעלים את הגדולים, הגדולים מעלים את המלבנים,
המלבנים
מעלים את הגדולים. אליעזר עוזר.
So let's just talk about what this machlokas is. I don't want to go through all the details of each one. There's some very interesting material the Rambam brings from the Yushalmi. But for our purposes, it means the following. Let's just say I have either different colored fig cakes, or figs, or I have cakes of figs, or it could be individual figs, bigger and smaller, or I have figs pressed into some shape of different shapes. Some are round, and some are rectangular or square. And I know that one of these was truma, and it gets mixed in. So I have 100 discrete items there. I have 100 figs. I have 50 black figs, approximately 50 black figs, approximately 50 white figs. A fig falls in, that's truma. And I don't know, and I know it was a white fig that fell in. So, if you would ask me, I would have said, well, the black figs, you can eat all of them. And the white figs, well, you can't eat any of them because you don't have mea white figs of chulin keneged the one fig of truma. Well, now, I have 100 figs, but I know that 50 of them are not the safek fig. Nonetheless, Rabbi Yoshua claims, if it fell in, I can pretend that I'm colorblind between black and white. Probably more being blind than colorblind. And therefore, I have 100 figs. I don't know which is the usher one. I had circular cakes and square cakes, right? I know it was a circular fig, a circular cake of truma figs, and I have 50 of those, and I have 51 of the rectangular ones, and I'm going to say, I don't remember what shape that fell in. I'm bad with my shapes. Therefore, I have 100 fig cakes, and I have one which is truma mixed in. I can eat them all. Very strange. Okay, Rabbi Eliezer says, what are you talking about? Rabbi Akiva has the most interesting...
Well, he says, oh, so does that mean just the white?
Correct. He only asks, as a general rule, if you can remove, if you know that something is, if it's mixed together, but you can remove it and there's no tam, you can eat it. Okay, Rabbi Akiva has the centrist, the compromise position, which is... So he says that when it's yadua what fell in, I know a black fig fell in. Well, it's not malazozo because I know that it's one of the black figs. So I can't say that the white figs help to be mevatel the black fig because they're not. I can pull them out. But if I don't know, I know a fig fell in, right? A kohen, a nasty kohen, goes up to my pile. He said, I have a fig behind my back, but you don't know what color it is. And he slips it in. So I know I either have a white fig or a black fig mixed into a pile, mixed of black and white figs. So now I know that there's one fig of truma, and I have 100 figs of chulin, all of which, and that of the 101, which could be a suffix of being the fig that he put in the pile. So Rabbi Akiva says that it's batel there. And in Mishnah Tess, he explains. Hold on one second.
Is it meh or meh? Is it one hundred?
You need 100 chulin keneged the one of truma. So you need 100 out of 101 total.
Oh, so one out of 101.
One out of 101 is batel. Anything more than one out of 101 is... It's about that, right.
Right.
Okay, go ahead. Mishnah Tess. Okay, in this case, Rabbi Eliezer was the Machmir, Yeshua was the Mako, and now the Mishnah is going to go on to describe. We're not going to read now. It's actually very important. We will at some point broach this later in the year. In the context of Davar Sheba Minyan. I know those of you who heard me talk about Davar Sheba Minyan think about halachic change and Xeris of Sanhedrin. That's one kind of Davar Sheba Minyan, but here I mean something totally different. Davar Sheba Minyan means something that is sold by count, by number, by unit, as opposed to, you know, where each one is considered chashuv. So that's the more classic Davar Sheba Minyan that we spend time on in the base medrash. Okay, so that's what those two Mishnayos have. Okay.